Okay, we're good. Firstly, I suppose we have to wish everybody Chag Sameach, Chag Atzmaut Sameach. It's according to Shemot Torah, Yom HaTzmaut was yesterday. According to the rest of Klal Yisrael, it's today.
According to the rest of Klal Yisrael, it isn't. So be careful.
Well, that's
according to the Tzionim.
Okay. Well, all right. That depends who you're talking about. But saying that, I was watching the Kotel Cam today, and it really is quite a spectacle. There was a Maariv, must have been at least 1,000 people dining Maariv together in the Kotel. It's not a big crowd, but it was a nice, obviously looked a very nice crowd, and was dancing after. It's a very special time in Israel. Okay, we are bang in the middle, right in the middle of the Gideon episode, and we're going to look at Perek Zion. What we said last week, very briefly, is that Gideon is the judge with doubts. He's the doubtful hero. He's the guy that all the way along, as much as he has this tremendous, I suppose you call it simple faith, in the sense that, you know, he comes from the lowest tribe and he doesn't have all the yichus and he doesn't have all the hype of all the people like Otniel ben Kenaz, who came from such, you know, came from Yehuda and had such a sort of strong connection. It's interesting that nevertheless he becomes the man at this point. He develops a tremendous relationship with God, but as we saw last week, he always needs encouragement. I suppose we all do, right? We all need encouragement at some time or another. But he constantly needs an encouragement from Hashem. And that's why he's an interesting character. He's not your obvious leader. He performs in an incredible situation. He goes through this battle, as you'll see in a minute, which is a famous story. The couple of things I just want to sort of bring into play over here, as we go through this, there are a number of sort of anecdotes that I can share with you. The question of the kneeling there's an interesting story that when we get to it, I'll just share it with you, because it's something that happened in my wife's family a few years ago. We're on chapter 7. We'll go through the psukim very quickly, and as we go through it, you know, we'll make our comments, and then there is a piece to look at, which really, again, asks the basic question: what was Gideon so worried about? If God is with him and Hashem is speaking to him, then, you know, you've got God on your side, right? Like most of the people who drive in Brooklyn think they've got God on their side. That's why they can do what they do, and I suspect it's the same in the Catskills in the summer. They all think they've got God on their side. It's in this case, he really does. Perek Zion, the Ashkenu Baal Hu Gideon. He's now got this title, Yerub Baal, right? He's the guy who fights the Baal. The Cholam Asheito, all the people with it. The Yachnu Ein Charod, they go to camp in this place. Remember, the Midianites are beginning to build up the war against Israel. Machnei Midian Ha'er, Mitzafo, Megiva Hamora, Megivata Hamora, Be'emek. And on the other side, towards the north, the camp of Midian. The Yor Hashem Ogidon. Now you see here, straight away, he's got a very strong relationship with God. All right, this is Hashem talking directly to him. There's no concept here of a Navi or somebody coming along to have to be an intermediary. Gideon has elevated himself. And Hashem says, Rav Amasheita, Mititi et Midian Biadam. And this is one of the parsha where I always argue Hashem's got a bit of a sense of humor. All right, it's an irony here that Gideon is worried about the battle. So what does Hashem say to him? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to cut your army down by 99%. Approximately, well, it's about 95%. Okay, you've got 32,000 men. We're going to whittle it down, and you end up with 300. Okay, suicidal in the extreme. 32,000 is a real army. 300 is ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous because Hashem says quite clearly, Gideon, this is the message to you. The message to you is that it's not about physical strength. Okay, it's not about the ability to fight because you've got greater numbers than anybody else. It's about the situation of connection, the spiritual connection that you have to God. And this is what happens in Pasuk Bet. There's too many people with you. Your army is too big. And if the Jews win, they'll start patting themselves on the back and they'll say, Yodi Yoshua, Kochi Etzel Yodi Yosel Esachal Ezeh. Alright, the classic reference here to something which is mentioned in the Torah, that Hashem does not want the people just to think that because of their own abilities and powers they are managing to achieve what they achieve. So it's not going to be like that. So how do you whittle down the numbers? You've got 32,000 men. Alright, you're gonna knock it down. So listen to this. The Atakra Nabaz Neha'am Lemor Mi Arev Charev. call out to the people, anyone who's scared, Yashov Yitzpor Mehar Gilad. He should Yitzpor, Tzipor, fly away. Okay, it's a great word, Yitzpor. Go and take a flight. But Yashov in arms, so how many people went home? It's a staggering number. Esri Mishnaim Elef, Aser Talafim, 22,000 really went home. Alright, 10,000 stayed, but 22,000, I mean, that's like two-thirds of the army were tittering, they were plotting, they didn't want to be there.
Well, they took the opportunity to.
That's it, and of course, what was their commitment in the first place? Must have been very weak. But 10,000 still remain. So 10,000 still sounds like a large number. So they Yomer Shema Gidon, Od Hamrav, still too many. Horeda Tamon Mayim, now we're going to find out who the real guys are. There's a famous story, you take them to the water, that Sarfemu Lechasham, I will be with you there, as it were, I will purify them. The tzaref is somebody who purifies metal. V'haya asher omar elecha ze yelech itach, hu yelech itach. Whoever I say goes with you, goes with you. V'chol asher omar elecha ze lo yelech imach, lo lo yelech. And the one who doesn't go with you will not go with you. I just noted over here the itach and imach. It's an interesting thing that you can do in Hebrew. Itach and imach, right, is something where there's the Vilna Gaon points this out with Bilam. Right, the story of Bilam is that Hashem says to Bilam, "Lech itam, go with them." All right, and as soon as Bilam gets on his donkey and to go with them, Hashem gets angry. Ve'ichaaf Hashem. So what's going on over there? All right, and the reason why Hashem is angry, the Vilna Gaon explains, because it says Vayelech imam. Right, he went with them. Im itach means to go with somebody, just literally walking with somebody, not thinking the same ideas. Bilam was going supposedly to bless the Jews, and they wanted him to curse the Jews.
Tag along.
He'll tag along.
The Jews associate.
Correct. But imam means that he's going with the same machshava. And that's what Bilam's problem was, that he went with the same idea, and that's why Hashem got angry. And it's all in the words in Hebrew, which you can't do in English. With in English is with. Okay, and that's it. But in Hebrew, itach and imach have two connotations. Itach, with you, just physically, walking along. Imach means with you psychologically, with the same idea. So here, I'm not sure if you can work this into this pasuk. Hashem says to him, Zeyelech itach, hu yelech itach, whoever I say should go with you, will go with you. Alright, again, are we saying that everybody here is going to be of the same mind? Alright, maybe the suggestion is that it's going to take an incredible event and not everybody will be on the same wavelength as Gidon. So they'll go with you physically, but will they go with you with the same intention, with the same machshava? I'm not sure. But the ones that are not going to go with you are clearly not going with you because they're not of the same mind. All right, they're already being disqualified, and we'll see why in a minute. So I'm trying to work the itach and imach idea into this pasuk. I'm not sure if I'm right. I'm not sure if it makes such a great difference in the pshat, but it's kind of interesting to note in Hebrew you can do that. All right, we'll go on. Hey, vayored asam el amaim. So they go down to the water. Vayom Hashem el Gidon, and this is constantly now. Hashem has got this open line. Kol hashe yilok b'lishono min amaim, kashe yilok hakelev, tatziga telavad, v'kol hashe yichra b'kav lishtot. There's going to be two groups of people: the lappers. I suppose you say the schlappers. No, the lappers and the kneelers, right? The guys are going to lap the water without kneeling. They're good guys. The guys are going to kneel down and sort of look into the water. They're not the guys you want. Okay? The Mephoshim explained very simply, because the guys are kneeling down, looking into the water, they see their own reflection. And this is a generation where Avodah Zarah, idolatry, was still a big problem. And the suspicion would be that they're getting a bit of a kick out of looking at their own reflection. Maybe it's a simon that they would not be too averse to bowing down to an image. If they're just going to not kneel nearby, they're just going to lap the water, right, like this, then maybe they're not people who are inclined to bow down on the knee. And therefore, in such a case, those are the people you want. Okay, I'll tell you a little story, and the story is an interesting story. My wife's father, about 16 years ago, was awarded a DSC. It's a very, very high honor in England. And the awards ceremony was in, the Albert Hall, one of these big sort of places in London. And the guest of honor who gave out all the degrees, it was from London University, was Princess Anne, okay, the Queen's daughter. Now, this ceremony went on for about 3 hours. After 2 hours, Princess Anne was completely wiped. She was like falling asleep. Her lady-in-waiting was a lady in nudging, actually. She kept her awake. It was really funny. And, of course, who gets the last degree? The guys who do the high-level guys. And my father-in-law was like sort of almost the last guy. Behind him, there was a Sikh. All right, and part of the deal was when you got this degree, she had to put a hood on your head. It was like from Elizabethan days, or who knows where it was from. It was some unbelievable sort of ceremony. But what was so interesting is that my father-in-law had a big shaila, and the shaila was that in order to get hooded, you had to kneel down on some sort of stool, and he wanted to know, could he kneel down on the stool or not? All right, because it's right in front of Princess Anne, and maybe there is a possibility. If you want to join us, Bakasha. There's maybe a possibility that kneeling down is a question of, who knows, Marisayin of Avodah Zarah. Alright? So he went to what I consider to be a very right-wing gentleman in the community, who said under no certain terms, this is not Avodah Zarah, you can kneel and she can do what she does, it's an honor, it's nothing to do with idolatry, just don't worry about it. The guy behind him was a Sikh, and you know what the Sikh did? He held both sides of this stool, and he didn't put his knees down on the stool whatsoever. So interesting. He was obviously, religiously, right, more machmir than the Jews. And what happened was that he was worried that if he put his knees down, then in a chanan, this was going to be like idolatry as far as he was concerned. It was so interesting. So, you know, just to see the difference, and of course I was reminded of this story. These are the guys that they take the water, they're not going to kneel. Because my question is, why the rabbi wasn't worried about that particular incident in Tanakh to say to my father-in-law, you shouldn't kneel. But obviously it wasn't really comparable, and it wasn't really the same situation. But I always remember that story, the kneeling story. The other funny story was that, of course, she has a conversation with everybody. So afterwards we went up to him and said, what did she say? And he said, he was so desperate for the bathroom, he said he doesn't remember a word of what she said. After 3 hours of sitting there, like everybody else, what are you going to do? It was a funny, funny story. But so we got the picture at home to prove it. So
that's why the Sikh guy didn't kneel.
And that's why he didn't kneel. Maybe he was more desperate. I don't know. It's a very funny story. It's a good anecdote because it fits in here very nicely to this particular item here. All right. So that's the story with at the moment with Gideon. All right. We're back to verse 6. Okay. How possible? So let's find out how many people he was left with. Who's left? 300 men. Everybody else got down on their knees to drink the water. And of course, what does Hashem say to Gideon? The thing that he doesn't want to hear. Vayomer Hashem el Gideon, Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, B'shlosh me'ot ha'ish ha'malachim moshia etchem. V'natat et Midian b'yadecha, 300 men, you're going to beat the Midianites. Now the problem is the Midianites numbered about, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands. So if you actually look at this as a numbers game, there's no chance. Everybody else should go home, and this is going to be the battle. 300 and a zillion, right? Or whatever it is. I don't know how many people. And look what it says. What happens is that this 300 have to take the provisions and their shofrot. The eight call Ish Israel, Shilach Ish Lolo, and everybody else goes home. And the camp of Midian was further down, and you're left with 300. Right? This is an interesting phrase. On that night, again, God speaks to him. He's got this constant conversation going on. Kum raid the machaneh, ki netativ biyadecha. Go down to the camp, and you'll see that you've already won the battle. The im yoreya talaredet. Now here comes an incredible thing. Gideon all the way through was, as we said, full of doubt. All right, he's a believer. He's got this open line to God. He's got this, you know, this is a wireless connection. There's nothing wrong with this. It's absolutely straight through. And it's God suggesting that he's afraid, which is very strange. Because, you know, already Gideon has gone past so many hurdles with so many signs, you know, with the fleece, the dry fleece, the wet fleece, and all that sort of thing we saw last week, and everything that we spoke about. And now Hashem is suggesting, if you're scared, then go down to the camp and you'll find that you'll be okay. So the question here clearly is, why now does Hashem, as it were, pull the carpet from under his feet? All right, something we'll come back to because it is very strange. And Gideon, of course, responds to this. Look at Pasuk Yud, v'mireyata loredet, if you're scared to go down to the camp to fight, redata pura nacha, take pura, your lad, with you, ela machaneh, v'shamata mayidaber, and you hear what they're talking. V'achat techezak liyadech, and then you'll become strong, v'yoradata b'machaneh, and you'll go against the camp, b'machaneh. All right, there's two phrases here, Ela Machana and Ber Machana. We're going to see that that's significant. So they went near to the men who were armed by the side of the camp. And who was there? And this is an emphasis. Midian, Amalek, V'chol B'nei Kedem, Noflim, Ba'emei, all of these guys were falling over each other in the valley. Ka'ar Be'lero, it was like locusts, right? They're not even being described as humans. It's like a mass of people. V'ligmalehem E'mispar, even the camels, who knows how many there were. K'chol Sh'asvat Ayam Le'ov, like the sand on the shore. It's a scary scenario. And again, you know, so if you ever see these sort of large-scale scenes in movies that they can produce today with computer graphics, you get some idea of this magnitude, you know, this small group on one side, and you've got this sea of men and camels and who knows what, which goes into the distance. You just can't see the end of it. And of course, this is very frightening. So what does Gideon do? He goes to the camp, and he hears a conversation. Chalom, they're talking about a dream. That's very strange. And the non-Jews are talking to each other, and they say, "Hinei chalom chalamte, had a dream. Hinei tzlil lechem sa'or misapech machne midyan, v'yavad ohel, v'yakil, v'yipol, v'yafcheil, v'lamala, v'nofal o." Basically, there was like a big wheel made out of barley. This is kind of a remez to the omer. Remember last week we said this is happening around Pesach time. Okay, and in fact, one of the things I think we say on the first night, maybe the second, I don't remember now which one it is, one of those things you say after Chasal Siddur Pesach refers to all the events that happen on Pesach. And this is, I think, one of the events that is referred to, I'm pretty sure, in whatever day of, you know, depends how drunk you are as to whether you remember the words or not. But it's said over there, if I'm not mistaken. So this is now the barley here, obviously, is some sort of remnant. As far as Gideon is concerned, it's the fact that they just did the Omer offering, right? And they brought some sort of offering, which now would hopefully be a merit for them. As far as the non-Jews were concerned, it was a sign of devastation. Something was going to come into the camp, the Nafal, the Oel, and the tents were going to fall down. And of course, the other guy, the Chochem over there in the camp, the friend who's talking to the two friends who are talking, the other guy says, you know what, I already know what this means. It's going to be the sword of Gideon that's going to come after us. The God of Israel has put into his hand at Midian with Kol HaMachaneh. We've lost. All right, so it's very interesting. The Gemara says in Brachot, and it's a famous, I've got about five pages of Gemara there, about dreams. Okay, if you have a dream, then get it interpreted in a good way. The dreams go according to the interpretation. Okay, I suppose Sigmund Freud knew this, but I don't know if he knew it from the Gemara. Okay, you know, this is the interpretation of dreams. There's a lot of books about this in the secular world. And the Gemara there gives some very, very weird and wonderful dreams that you may have and tells you what it means. I'm trying to think of a good example, the elephant in your dream. I'm not quite sure what that's about. I remember now. I remember there's like dozens of examples there of things that you might see in your dream. If you see a Sefer Torah in your dream. I don't know what happens if you see the Red Sox. I'm not quite sure what happens in that case. For the Yankee fans, it's not very good. Sorry?
But it's a nightmare.
There's a nightmare. Yeah, okay. Well, my son-in-law will have to disagree with that. It's a very interesting concept. And here it's happening because the dream is being interpreted, right, as a victory. It's an absolute victory for the Jews. Now Gideon hears this. Pasuk Tedvav. As I said, we're running through the Pesukim. I'm going to go back onto the question we raised before about Gideon's about Hashem being worried for Gideon. That's something that I think we need to clarify. But we'll come back to it in a minute. Vayehi Kishma. Just the story is so great. Vayehi Kishma Gideon and Mispar et Mispar Chalom et Shivro. He heard what the dream meant, interpretation, and they were very happy. They bowed down because they realized that this was it. We have won the battle. God is on our side. And what did he do? Three camps, right? Avon Yitzhak Yaakov. It's very interesting. It's called it again. The theme of Pesach is running through here. Right, three matzahs. This three is not without significance. So he's divided the camp, 100 and 100 and 100. They went with literally empty vessels. They went with a shofar, and they went with these empty kind of pitchers, the lapidim b'tocha kadim, and their torches, their kind of you know, sort of how they would see ahead would be with this long piece of wood or whatever it was, and that was inside the pitcher. And how are they going to fight this battle? And this is very interesting. When I teach this, I always get very depressed. For the simple reason that when I ask a student about a certain movie, which I'm sure everybody has seen, this generation hasn't seen any of it. Cast a Giant Shadow, right? Now, I suppose most people, some of you may remember when it came out. Fabulous film. And there's a scene there with Frank Sinatra. He's the pilot, right? Who's one plane in the Israeli army. It's unbelievable. It's one airplane. And it's a suicidal mission that he has, but he's flying over the Egyptians. And what he does is he has these soda bottles, all right? But the Israeli soda, if you know what that is. It used to have a wonderful title of the company called Syphilux. I always thought it was something to do with, well, I don't want to go there. But it was always worrying me, that name. And it was, the scene was that he's flying over the Negev, and he's dropping these soda bottles out of the plane. And as they come whizzing down, they make a terrible noise. It sounds like a bomb, but of course it's just glass. Smashes on the ground. But what do you see? You see the Egyptian army, you know, literally hundreds of guys in tanks and whatever. But all of a sudden you hear this whizzing, all right, and crash, boom, and the noise is not very great, but it's enough to scare everybody. And you see the Arab leaders there, you know, the tank commanders turning around and literally getting out of the tanks and running back to Egypt. They literally ran away. And it was a battle which was won by noise. The sad thing was that the plane was eventually shut down, all right, because they had a couple of planes more than we did. We had one, they had three or something. So, you know, when you think about today, the Israeli army just doesn't make, it really is unbelievable. The whole mace of what happened in 1948 is still, I think of all the wars, is clearly the most remarkable, because there was no army to speak of. All right, you had the Haganah and the groups, and you had a whole bunch of refugees who didn't know which way to hold a gun. I had my mother had a cousin who was killed in that war. He came from Poland, from the camps. He was literally given a gun, put into the army, and I don't know. I think he survived maybe a week of that war. I'm not quite sure. I don't know when his yahrzeit is, but it's an unbelievable thing. Cast a Giant Shadow. Cast a Giant. If you've never seen that movie, you have to. It's part of growing. As far as I'm concerned, it was part of growing up. It's also got Kirk Douglas with the dimple. He's great, right? And are you guys in this movie? You've got John Wayne in the movie. You've got Frank Sinatra, Kirk Douglas. What more? Phenomenal lineup. Phenomenal lineup. And if you've never seen it, you can get it from. I'm sure the library has it in various other places. Incredible, absolutely incredible thing. All right, I digress, but the example is really what we're talking about here. It's going to be a war which is won in a non-conventional way, by a lot of noise. Listen to this, Pasuk Yud-Zayin. Vayor alehem imeni tiru v'chein tasu. So Gideon says, follow me, what I do, you do. I'll go to the edge of the camp. Just copy what I do. So he's got 300 guys who are all sittering there probably, and this guy was holding a few pitchers with a few empty pitchers, right, empty vessels, and they're having this war. And it's against you. You've got thousands and thousands of camels and who knows what instruments and implements and swords and it's unbelievable. Yeah.
You have to disagree that they're all tittering. They're probably,
these are the good
ones that were not afraid to go.
Correct. I would.
And they realize that if they're down to 300 and Hashem says, I'm going to give them,
then hopefully it's going to work.
We're in, whatever
true,
you tell.
True, yeah, we're in for better or for worse. I would still argue, and a lot of people say this, that, you know, the actual final moment before you go into war, one of the scariest moments that I had, I did the Israeli Army basic training over 20 years ago, and one of the scariest moments was the demonstration of what they call an RPG. RPG is an anti-tank gun, and it wasn't what the gun could do, but it was the noise. We were literally a mile away from this thing, and the noise, the boom was so loud, and I thought to myself, God forbid, that lands next to you, you know, you can just scramble your brains, and it can drive you crazy. This was a famous thing in World War One. The bombs had created a tremendous problem because the noise was so great, even if it wasn't new, but people got shell shock, and they never recovered from it. So the element of noise in war is very significant. And my argument is, again, I would say you're right. Obviously, they are the most confident of the people, but I would imagine they still have a bit of doubt, because, you know, until they actually see the nays, what's going to be? And ain't some chalal nays, you know, you shouldn't rely on a miracle, which I presume is why they had to make this noise. I remember reading in, I think it was Yigal Yadin or Moshe Dayan's, one of those guys who wrote about one of the battles in 56, and I think they copied a lot of the strategy from this in terms of the noise, and in also from the Battle of Ai, where they went, you know, from, they did a, like an attack from the front, but they had one group of people coming from the rear, all right, and they did that particular maneuver as well. And as far as people like Yigal Yadin and people like Moshe Dayan, they weren't religious people by any means, but the Tanakh, the Navi here, was a guidebook for them. They would use it as an absolute guide of how to fight battles. A phenomenal thing. All right, and I think this is what Rav Kook said. That Rav Kook said that in the end of the day, you know, as much as these people are not religious, who are building the land, we can still learn from them in a tremendous amount. Their Mesiras Nefesh for Eretz Yisrael was unreal. All right, it wasn't a Mesiras Nefesh for Yiddishkeit, unfortunately. It was Mesiras Nefesh for the land, but it was something that we could even learn from that. People like Dayan and those sort of people were totally enveloped in the essence of sort of Jewish history. Not necessarily Jewish life, but certainly Jewish history. And it's, again, a remarkable thing that these people came along when they did. So all of these chapters in Tanakh are very significant in our generation, not just in those generations, but in our generation as well. I just want to finish the chapter, and then I just want to share with you this insight. But Takati b'shofar, what are you going to do? I will blow the shofar. Anochi v'chol ha'sheiti, everybody with me. U'takatem b'shofar, so you lot will do the same thing. Gam atem suyot kol ha'machaneh, v'amartem l'shem v'l'gidon. Reminds me of like a Shakespeare, right? For Harry and England. So this is for God and for Gideon, okay? Vayova Gideon u'meir ish ha'sheito. So he went with 100 men, b'kzeh ha'machaneh, at the end of the camp, rosh ha'ashmoret ha'tichona. There was a certain group, they were known as the Middle Watch, or it was the time of the Middle Watch, that they divided the night into different timings, that it was a changeover of the guard. Acha keim hekim es ha'shomrim. They established the guards, vayitku b'shofarot, and in the meantime they blew with the shofar, v'nafotza kadim asher b'yadam, and they smashed the jars which they had in their hand. And of course the noise, the racket was unbelievable. Vayitku shloshet arashim b'shofarot, vayishbu kadim, and everybody else did exactly the same. V'achziku b'yad smolam b'lapidim. They held the pitchers in their left hand. U'b'yad yiminam ha'shofarot litkoa, and in the right hand the shofar. So the halachis here have a very interesting deal. That's what you're supposed to do with the shofar. You hold the shofar in your right hand. All right? And that's the way you do it to this very day. And it's not actually learned from a pasuk in the Torah, but it's learned from the story of Gideon, how to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. It's very interesting, just out of the blue. Okay? It just points out that the shofar wasn't Rosh Hashanah. But it's, I suppose, you know, maybe that becomes the more powerful way of blowing the shofar. I'm not quite sure. But whatever. They started blowing, they yikru, and they called out, Cherev Lashem v'Gideon. They changed the cry. But presumably that was what Gideon meant in the first place. The sword, which is now going to win the battle, is the sword for God. All right, Hashem is with us, and the Gideon, and he is leading us. And of course, the model of leadership in war has always been that the leader goes ahead. He leads the battle. All right, I always think of the British, they always had the guy sitting in the office while everybody else was getting killed. The Jewish concept was no. Gideon was out there. Ehud Ben-Gael was leading, remember in chapter 3. All the time, you know, Barak, they're all out there, they're leading. They're leading from the front because they represent this tremendous concept of bitachon. And when you've got bitachon, you don't have to sit in the office. You know, even if the arrows come in that direction towards you and you're at the front, you hope that Hashem is with you and you will survive. Different concept of leadership. And I think even in the army today, that's why so many high-ranking people get killed in the army. Because they're out there. They're out there in the front lines, right? They're not sitting back in Tel Aviv sort of planning the wars. They're actually fighting the wars. And this is a problem, I suppose, in the Israeli army to this very day. Alright, Chafalov. It's kind of significant we're doing this around Yom HaTzmur. I find that this, you know, plus Hashanah, nothing changes in terms of Jewish battles. Except here, I mean, again, we are outnumbered. Even today we're outnumbered. Okay, we know that 50 million or how many millions of Arabs and 5 million Jews. It's the numbers don't relate. They really don't relate. They never have related. And yet, you know, we're still sort of celebrating Yom HaTzmur. We're still celebrating the existence of Am Yisrael. It's a phenomenal name. And I think one has to bear that in mind. Whatever one feels about the state of Israel, it's an incredible thing that it's happening in our generation. Basically, everybody starts running because, you know, panic sets in. They blow the shofarot, then they took their sword and they started literally carving their way through the camp. Beit HaShita is where you get now the nice cucumbers come from, the pickles come from Beit HaShita. That's where they went. Ad Safat Avel Mechola Al Tabat Mechola. This place is where I did my army service, so I know it very well. It's a hole in the ground, but that's what it is. I think it's near Yericho, that part of the country. Vayitzaeg Ish Yisrael Min Naphtali Min Asher Min Kol Min Asher. Everybody join in. Vayirvachrei Midian, and they started chasing Midian. Umalachim Shalach Gidon B'chol Ha'Ephraim Leimor. Now Gidon calls in the reinforcements. Ephraim was not originally included in the battle. This is going to be a problem in the next chapter, which I hope you'll read ahead for next week, because Gidon at the end becomes a big disappointment, as you'll see. Okay, I'm not going to preempt it now, but read ahead and you'll see what happens with Gidon. Just a warning, by the way, advance warning, that in 2 weeks' time, I'm not going to be here, there won't be a shit. I'm going to be out of the country. Well, I'll be in the country, but I'll just be back, coming back from England. So next week there'll be a shit, please God, but in 2 weeks' time not, then hopefully 3 weeks' time there will be. And after that, we'll sort of see how it goes. All right, let's get back to this sense of the story. They're chasing from Ha'Ephraim, they're coming down. Redu likrat Midian velikdu lahem et amayim, right? Well, basically what you've got to do is you've got to capture them, seize them before them, the water. In other words, you've got to get to the water first so that you can cut them off. Ad Beit Barat, this place, Vete Yardin, and by the Jordan, Vyitza'eh Kolish Ephraim, Yokudu et amayim, Ad Beit Barat, Vete Yardin, and they followed Gidon without question. They went to that place, and of course the Midianites are running towards them, and it's complete chaos. Vyokudu Shnei Sarei Midian et Orev et Zev, and of course the ultimate defeat was the defeat of the two princes of Midian, so one guy called Orev and one guy called Zev. Okay, wolf and raven. Very, very great sort of naming ceremonies they must have had for those guys. I don't know, whatever. The Yaragu at Orev, but to Orev, and of course where he was killed became the rock of Orev, but Ze'ev, and this guy Ze'ev, Horgu B'Yekev Ze'ev, became the wine press of Ze'ev. Okay, I suppose not really a name that he wanted to perpetuate in that way, but that was where he was killed. And to prove that they were dead, they took off their heads, as it were, and brought it to Gidon over the Jordan. This is the battle of battles, and it is an incredible, incredible description. The sense of victory, the sense of overwhelming. Inclusion here of God in the battle is amazing. And as I said, right, we go back to the beginning there, the Apostle Zion, right, and we see that when Hashem talks about this battle, so Apostle Yud, Im Yorei Ata Lareda, he's suggesting that Gidon is still afraid. Now, what's going on over here? Why is Hashem, at this point in time, putting doubts into the mind of Gidon? If Gidon has already sort of gone through to this point with all of the signs that he had and with all of the simanim, everything that he's had till now, and he is ready to, he's gung-ho, this is it, why now does Hashem say, Mirei Ata Lareda? If you're scared, just go down and get another piece of evidence to prove to you that it's all going to work out for the best. There is a din in the Torah, there's a law of the Torah which says, Lo Tanachashu. Lo Tanachashu means that, generally speaking, we don't rely on signs. Alright, we're not very keen on the black cat and the not walking under a ladder and all that sort of thing, the superstition, we don't do it. We're kind of superstitious, but we don't like to admit it. But we really don't. We try not to be. And the Torah goes out of its way to avoid all of that stuff because it's considered to be part of pagan ritual. It comes from idolatrous culture, whichever way you want to understand it, and we try not to do it. Of course, the interesting thing, if we ever get to Shmuel Aleph, is the Witch of Endor. Because there, Shaul has to go to a witch, a Balat Ov, as she is called, and that's the only person who can put him in touch with Shmuel. Right, and the terrible thing is that he spent his whole career getting rid of them because to him they represented what was so negative in Eretz Yisrael, the negative influence. He got rid of them, and then he has to go and find one because it's the only way he can talk to his Rebbe. And it's really sad. You feel terribly upset for him at that point. But generally speaking, this idea of divining, trying to find a sign which will give you some sort of indication about the future, we don't usually do. And the Rambam, for instance, has got a very big question, and it's brought in a number of places about what happens with Eliezer when he looks for a sign. Rivka's going to come out. The the one that brings out the water is going to be the one that is going to marry Yitzchak. And there's a story also in Shmuel Aleph where Yonatan, the son of Shaul, goes to the camp of the Plishtim, and he makes he goes by himself with, or rather, he goes with his lad, but he's two people by themselves, and he basically makes a siman. And the sign, he says, if the Plishtim come up towards us, all right, then it's a sign that we're going to win the battle. If they invite us into their camp, or rather, so the other way, if they invite us into their camp, it's a sign that we're going to win, because they're just being so lax and open. But if they come up towards us, then maybe it's a sign that we won't win. And again, Chazal are very perplexed, and the Mefarshim are very perplexed. How could you do this? What sort of allowance could you do to make such a sign? Isn't it against the law of the Torah? Where the Torah seems to say quite clearly, don't make these simanim, these kind of signs that might indicate one way or the other. You rely on Hashem, Batech Bashem, and that's the way it goes. So again, the question will be, is Gideon over here relying on a sign or not? And if he is, and Hashem is suggesting to him to do it, how do we understand this? It goes against this principle of not relying on signs, not relying on simanim. So I'll share with you this piece, because this is a very, very precious insight.
The simanim, that it doesn't compare. The siman of Shaul, the siman was a witch.
Yeah.
A sorceress.
Yeah.
A siman of Eliezer. And Rivka, it's an idea of personality or character.
Correct. But at the same time, it's making you're almost testing God. You know, you're saying what will come out, whoever comes along, or in the case of Yonatan, if the Plishtim do this, or if the Plishtim do that, will be a sign for us that we are going to either win or going to lose. And that again is something which, are you allowed to do this? We're going to see that the Ran says yes. Well, actually, this is not what the Torah forbids. In other words, what your comment is actually correct, and we'll see why. There are certain signs which the Torah forbids, divination or whatever you want to call it.
It gives examples in Vayikra,
Correct, but the problem is that if these events seem to mirror those types of activities, how would it ever be allowed? And we're going to suggest that with Gideon, as with Yonatan, as with others, there is a tremendous allowance for them to do this. That when is a sign forbidden? When you're absolutely relying on the sign. The Ran says that when a sign comes about, which is so logical, and it would follow logic to suggest what it suggests, then it's not a forbidden sign. For instance, in the case of the camp of the Plishtim, if they're going to be so laid back about it and invite you into the camp, then it means that they don't take their security very seriously. So not only is that a sign, as it were, that the Jews are going to win, it's logical to suggest that we're going to win because they let us in. All right. In other words, it follows the logic. Not only does the sign become a siman in the true sense, but it's also a logical step. If Rivka brings out the food, then it's a logical thing to assume that this is a balat chesed, and she's going to be kind and whatever, and she's certainly fit to marry Yitzchak. And we're going to say the same thing over here with Gideon, that if Gideon goes into the camp and he hears the people talking about defeat, then this is nothing more than a logical conclusion of what Hashem says to him, that when you go there and you hear what the Midianites are going to be saying, then you will know that you're going to win. All right, and this is not going against the Torah. The Torah, when the Torah says don't make a siman, it's talking about an illogical sign. All right, like the black cat, you see something walking across your path, and then you assume it's going to be, a bad day. Something's going to happen, and it's going to be not good. Whichever way you look at it, it's not the same thing as what we're talking about here. That's going to be one suggestion. I just want to share this with you, because I think this is really very, very interesting. This comes again from the Sefer of Yitzhak Levi, which I use a lot in my teaching, and he says something really very profound here. We're going to take it from the third paragraph down, where it's underlined on the right-hand side. The RFLP came yesh lishol. In the previous paragraph here, he points out that what we said before, loredet b'machaneh, loredet elamachaneh. Gideon is told, loredet b'machaneh, go and make war. And Gideon is not sure, or seemingly there is a question in his mind, so Hashem says, loredet el hamachaneh, go to the camp, the enemy camp, see what's going on there, and then you can go b'machaneh, then you can make war. So in terms of the language of el hamachaneh and b'machaneh, there is a difference between what those two phrases actually mean. But the question of questions still is, why does Hashem seem to suggest to Gideon that he will be afraid? If he's already had all of these signs that God is telling him to go and fight the war, and you've now down to 300 of the best men, and you've done everything that you can possibly do, you got rid of all the idolaters and everybody else, then what are you worried about? And why does Hashem say to him, if you are afraid, then go down to the camp and listen to what they're discussing. You know, it's very strange. So listen to this. This is a very wonderful insight. There's two approaches here. Afal pi ken, it's the, as I said, the third paragraph, that way it's underlined. Afal pi ken yesh lishol. We're still going to ask the obvious question. Keitzad zeh maleh Hashem bichlal efsharot. How can God bring it into the possible discussion here, Shegidon Yarei Laredit Lechem B'Midyan, that Gideon would be afraid to fight. How can you suggest that? Kvar Ra'inu, we've already seen, B'chol Ma'asav, whatever he's done so far, Et Gvurat Nafsho, is a very brave individual. Alright, this is a man of metal, as they say. M-E-T-T-L-E, I think is the spelling. Not something from the Wizard of Oz. Not that man of metal. He's a man, that as well. He's a man of strength. You remember the original story that the whole city wants to attack him because he destroyed all the altars, and he stood up to them with another 10 guys against all those people. And he's had all the signs from God. God made all these incredible things happen. Hamalach, the angel, chilat ha'esh, the fire consumed the food, the gizat ha'tzema, and the whole thing that we read last at the end of last week's share about the fleece. Now, hateshuvah lekach, what is really going on here? Bepiv sherabeinu bachya bechovot alavavot. This is a classic sefer of Jewish philosophy. If you've never opened it before, It's a must. Chovot HaLevavot is a wonderful book from the Spanish school. Ben Abachia Ibn Pakuda, I think it is. I think 13th, 14th century. Major personality in Jewish philosophy. He writes the following. He says this is the Shah Yichud Hamasa. This is one of the... He divides it into gates, the different books, the different parts of his book. And he says the following. Hashem Tzivah B'Kai. He's talking about Gideon. He says God commanded him to go to the camp. We said this already last week. Gideon was not testing God. Gideon had a tremendous lack of, I suppose you would call it self-confidence. He did not trust his own righteousness. He made himself very small. And through that he found grace in the eyes of Hashem. Gideon was a guy who really didn't believe that he would ever win anything. He didn't believe that was ever worthy of achieving a victory in this battle. Look what he says here. This is Reb Levi's interpretation. Rabbeinu b'chayim meshiv b'dvarav elu al sheila shel moreh. He's answering the question, which we've already raised. Ha'im lo haya b'shmiyat divrei ha-midyanim mishum issa lo tenachshon. Listening to the Midianites, surely that is part of what the Torah forbids, where it says, don't look for signs, divination, or whatever you want to call it. You're not supposed to have amongst your people this type of activity going on, that people are using signs and simanim to predict the future or whatever. So Rabbeinu Bachya makes the conclusion here, Devarav Sham, his words, and he says, Kivan Shadavar Ken, since Hashem Tzivah, since God has commanded him to go down to the camp, this is not considered to be divination, looking for signs of victory, none of the sort. The question is, of course, why not? Ben Abachir says not, but he doesn't explain. So Rav Levi wants to add the run. There's two cases where people were looking for signs. Eliezer with the story with Rivka, and Yonatan in Shmuel Aleph, chapter 14, where he's looking there for a sign as to whether they are going to win against the Philistines at that particular battle. And again, the same question. The in Tishal v'Tomar, so you ask, in Cain, Elashnaim, Hayu Menachashim Gemurim. In these two cases, they were really trying to guess what was going to be. Ech Nomar Be'elu Tzadikim Kacha. How can we say that Eliezer and Yonatan did this? It's against the Bible. It's against the Torah. But Teshuvah, the answer is, Kilo Nesa Nachash, When is this type of divination forbidden? When it's not logical. When you're looking for a sign which is coming out of the blue. But of course, in this case, in the case of Yonatan, and the case of Eliezer, it was kind of an obvious thing as well. It was logical. Ain't there nachash? It wasn't called nachash, any sort of divination or anything like that. Ki im minhago shel olam, it's the way of the world. The ain bein zeh bein ha'omer im yamtir macha nizra kudomer. It's like somebody who says, if it rains tomorrow, we'll go and plant. That's an obvious thing to say. You may say the rain is a sign that you should go and do it, but it's kind of obvious as well, because the ground will be soft. You'll be able to dig the ground and be able to put the seed in the ground. And of course, what the Ran says is that, in fact, logic dictated that what they said was absolutely right. In the case of Eliezer and in the case of Yonatan. Now, Hadibur Mashay Yishmu, the second side of the page, column. Hadibur Mashay Yishmu, Gidon and Pura, Na'or. What Gidon and Pura were going to hear, the Machane Midyan Enom Stam Nichush, this is not just looking for some sort of divination here. Ela Hasechu Moreh Mehem Apachat Chabosh Gidon. They're going to hear that the Midianites are scared about the sword of Gidon. Not even the men, it's not even the number of men with him, it's the cherem. That is something which for them becomes very scary. All right? I suppose you can argue because they heard about the sword of Ehud. You know, every time there is a tremendous victory going on, a cherem becomes very significant. We spoke about that with Ehud Ben-Gera. Shenafal alem, and this fear comes upon them. Third line, b'yadam shlo yuchu la'amod lefanav, they can't stand before him. Diburim eina yochichu lo l'gidon, and this will prove to Gidon she'ela od lachush the ribui mispam shabnei midyan amalei. Don't worry about the numbers; it's irrelevant. The chol bnei keder, all of the people who are against you, lumad mispam and say much shel anashav, and he's only got 300. It's not going to be a problem. And now we understand the da'atah shel Rabbeinu Bachya haya for hatzivui amiucham et Hashem. Why did God tell Gidon to go down there? Not just because it would be a logical thing to do, but he says it was absolutely a commandment from Hashem. Mibnei am v'tanuto mufleget v'choser bitchano b'zchuyotav. The extreme, as I said here in English, the extreme humility of Gidon. He doesn't believe that it's going to work for him this time. And I suppose the argument we'll have to say is that it's never the fact that Gidon has a crisis of faith in God. He has a crisis of faith in himself. That's the problem. Gidon is the guy who really doesn't believe that he's worthy for any of this to take place. And whenever he's questioning or he's not sure, it's not questioning the ability of Hashem to come to help him, as we said last week already. And we see here again, it's the ability of himself to warrant or to merit the help of God. And that is a very great madriga. This is on the lines of Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, Anav Mikol Adam. Not quite to that degree, but this is what Gidon is about. He's so humble. He doesn't believe it's going to happen for me. I don't get it. Ulechein, and therefore back to the text. His skim Hashem al yado. God agrees. Ki adayin yorei ulevedin milchamayis. He's scared to go to war. V'sholcho l'machaneh Midian. Amunat l'chazek et yadav. And now he's going to the camp of Midian to make him strong. So this is not a negative thing. This is not something which Hashem is saying to Gidon, you are weak. He's saying to him, you are strong. And I need just to remove that final element of doubt caused by your extreme humility. You were so humble and you didn't think this was going to happen for you. It's going to happen for you. And you know how you're going to know? Because you're going to go to the enemy camp and you'll hear they're already talking about defeat. All right? And once they're talking about defeat, that's it. It's all over already. You don't even have to, all you've got to do is make your noise, your gregors, you know, like from Purim. You just go and make a bit of a tumult, and then that's it. And they all start running away. It's unbelievable. But Uriah, listen to this. I'm just going to add a bit more, he says. Gidon was clearly perturbed by the fact he's left with 300 men. With all due respect, all of us will be perturbed. So what is Shmuel, who writes the book of Shoftim, coming to show you? He's showing you the enemy, the number is great, is enormous. pasuk shebein divrei Hashem elav lebein biato shegidol machne midyan. And that pasuk, the reference to the enemy, it comes again. It's actually mentioned twice, and it says that midyan amalek chomene kedem noflim ba'emek arbel ol. Again, remember the comparison. They were like locusts. Ligmalehem ein mispar. There's no limit to the number of camels that they have. Kachol ashvat ayam leol. They were like the sand on the seashore. I mean, unbelievable description. We heard this already at the beginning of chapter 7, and we have it again. And their tents, and they came upon the Jewish people like locusts. So what are we added here? Why do we repeat that description? This is what Shmuel wants to teach us by writing the story of Gideon. Gideon was still afraid. The numbers were still frightening. 300 and 3 million. Who knows how many they were? La'acha shemishloshimishnayim elef ish lo nishorito eloshloshmer. He only had 300. Lo'umat ha'mispar atzum shelo evolved compared to his enemy. And therefore Gideon's doubts were well founded on the one hand. On the other hand, he is a man of extreme spirituality. We can see that he's getting stronger the whole time. His connection to Hashem is tremendously close. God is literally, the line is open the whole time towards him. And the only thing we'll have to be able to say here is that God, when Hashem says Yoreata, if you are afraid, that is a suggestion not about Gideon's lack of emunah here, lack of faith. It's just Gideon's lack of self-confidence. He doesn't seem to have the confidence yet to believe that it's all going to happen because of him. And that is, again, a great quality of leadership. It's the quality which says that, you know, I'm going to do what I have to do, and I'm not really sure, I'm not really worthy of this, and I don't really deserve this. Whatever will be, you know, Mashiach, yeah. Whatever God will do will happen. And it's phenomenal. Gideon is a very inspirational character. As much as he has the doubts, which I think are so human, at the same time, he also has this crisis, I suppose you would call it, of self-confidence, but at the same time, when he's told, you do what you got to do, he goes and does what he does. Phenomenal character. The sadness, as I said, is next week when we look at Perichet, we'll see that Gideon, in the end, he blows it. He just doesn't follow through at the end. He does something very, very strange. I'm going to tell you. You'll have to read it for yourself. It's a very unusual story. And he seems to open the door to idolatry again in a way where he's been so strong against it. This is, you know, look what he's been doing here. And it's very sad. And again, needs a lot of explanation, Mitzvah Hashem, to be continued next week. I don't know who I like more. I like Gideon. I like Dever. I'm not sure. Shimshon is still to come. He's mind-blowing. All right? Shimshon is the ultimate. I just can't withhold my admiration for Shimshon, because this is a guy who, like Shaul, Shimshon and Shaul go in the same category. Unbelievable men who the circumstances of their lives seem to create tragedy, but they shine through it. Quite amazing. So Mitzvah Hashem to be continued. Okay, thank you everybody.
Thank you.